The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what about that Secretary of State, John Kerry? Boston Brahmin, New England upper crust, Secretary of State, former senator, married to a queen of society in New York, D.C., and Boston. Our election is apparently getting him a little red in the face when he talks to foreign leaders. Big whoop.
Everywhere I go, every leader I meet, they ask about what is happening in America. They cannot believe it. I think it is fair to say that they're shocked. They don't know where it's taking the United States of America. It upsets people's sense of equilibrium about our steadiness, about our reliability. And to some degree, I must say to you, some of the questions, the way they're posed to me, it's clear to me that what's happening is an embarrassment to our country.
John Kerry on CBS's Face the Nation explaining the 2016 election, or how it's been received in the eyes of foreign leaders. Imagine how mortified he'd be if he had to explain the Vietnam War he fought in, or being a member of the party of philandering and impeached Bill Clinton, or showing photo albums from Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Hey, buck up, folks. People around the world have questions about the 2016 election, but do we owe them answers? It's a debate. It's a discussion. And here to discuss with us is Robert Mann, a communications professor at LSU and a columnist at the Times-Picayune newspaper. Also with us is former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh.
I spend a lot of time traveling around the world and talking to leaders in various countries. And I would say that they're very, very nervous. They're perplexed. They want to be sure that America is going to lead and that Donald Trump is not going to be president.
And, you know, who cares what they think? This is a democracy. We're America here, and we got our act together, and we can elect whoever we want. Darn it.
Yeah, I think it's, as a lone superpower, the world looks to us for sensible leadership. And when we don't lead, the rest of the world responses, I call it sort of the jello response. They sort of wait and to see what we are doing, or the bad guys show up. For instance, in Syria, I don't think we've been leading enough, so the Russians are sort of driving the truck out there, and that's not good for the world or for us. And Americans does have to lead. We're the strongest economic military power, and when we get involved, things happen. They gel. When we don't get involved, or we say things like Donald Trump has been saying, the world gets very, very nervous. I think you're seeing, as he's getting his foreign policy team together, they're all quickly walking him back from the more ridiculous, naive statements that he's been saying. And I think that were he to get the nomination, you'd see a lot more. Having worked on four presidential campaigns myself, you pull in a whole team that kind of brings you down from the floating rhetoric into a little bit more practical policies, and you're seeing that happen with him as well.
Robert Mann, does any presidential candidate in the United States need to get the Putin vote and the British Tory vote?
I don't think that Trump sees the need for that at all. I think that Trump is playing a very particular game right now, and that is within the Republican Party. He is projecting to the image of the world, a guy who seems to be getting about 90% of the headlines, and perhaps people in other parts of the world don't realize that this is a man who has about 40% of one-third of the electorate, but he's getting all the news. He's gobbling up all the news, and he seems like an unstoppable juggernaut. But we know that Trump is enormously unpopular with women, Latinos, independents, and I think that if he gets the nomination, and once there's a general election, and once all those people have their say, that the image that the U.S. projects to the rest of the world might be markedly different than it is now if we reject him soundly, which I think the American people would eventually.
What message would that send if the American people rejected Donald Trump? Robert Mann?
A big sigh of relief.
Well, Robert Mann, let me just get your view on that, and then I have actually a question for you, Nancy.
Well, you know, I look back at history. I did a book about 20 years ago on the civil rights movement, and, you know, there was a time in the early 60s when the United States was sending an awful message to the rest of the world. In 1962 and 1963, during these violent civil rights marches and demonstrations, the world saw a very ugly image of the country. But it also saw the best of America in the summer of 1964 when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. The following year, we saw it again in Selma, awful images projected to the rest of the world. And then we saw the best of the country when Lyndon Johnson signed the bill that Congress passed to give voting rights to African Americans and to others. And I think that, the world adjusts its opinion of the United States pretty well.
Ambassador Soderbergh, doesn't John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, play a dangerous game in the sense that America has a longstanding tradition of, oh, they don't like what we're doing? Well, then we'll do 10 times more of it. There's an impatience with the rest of the world among mainstream Americans and their opinions about us, don't you think?
I think there is. And there's nothing, having been a diplomat at the United Nations, there's nothing more frustrating than trying to forge consensus among 194 different views. We are the biggest and the best, so why don't we just go do it on our own? The problem with that is that today's global threats are exactly that. We can't solve them on their own, and we have to persuade others to follow us in fighting terrorism, cyber threats, infectious disease, climate change, whatever, or you can take the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria. We can't do it all on our own, so we need to have the rest of the world following us. Now, it's not a popularity contest. I don't really care if the French like us, but I do care if they help us out in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. But it's very, very frustrating, and it's always tempting to say, heck with the rest of the world, we're just going to do what we want. And that's Donald Trump's approach, which, you know, on one level sounds quite refreshing until you look below that thin veneer of rhetoric and realize that the world's a lot more complicated, and we actually do need to lead global coalitions on today's challenges. We absolutely cannot go it alone.
Are the two of you basically agreeing that Donald Trump represents a problem for America's image in the world?
I think that what I've observed about Trump is that he's a man who has learned to work within whatever system he's in and exploits it. He's exploiting the existing political and governmental system during his career in business. He's done that pretty well. He brags about it on the stump. He's currently exploiting the Republican Party's primary system, which this year seems to reward his particular kind of behavior and rhetoric. And I think if the current primary season required him to be a different kind of candidate, I think he would adapt to that because he has no core principles other than adapting to and exploiting the system that exists at the time. And in the same way, I think he would be forced to adapt to the White House in a way that would force him to moderate his actions and his rhetoric. He will adapt because he always has.
Is it possible that all the attention on Trump keeps the world from seeing perhaps equally dangerous implications of a Cruz presidency or a Bernie Sanders presidency? I mean, they all know Hillary Clinton, of course.
Well, I think most of the Republican establishment and, frankly, the Democratic establishment as well is more frightened by Ted Cruz precisely because he's not malleable. I think Trump is governed largely by a narcissistic belief in himself. And when he were he to get in the White House, which I think, as Robert pointed out earlier, he's only got a small percentage of the electorate. But were he to get into office, what would happen is he would stumble around, try his rhetoric out on our allies, and essentially, fail for the first 2.5-3 years, and then probably end up, changing towards the second half of his first term, which I think would be a single-term presidency. But the truth is, we don't know. People, when they get into office, grow in ways that can be good or bad. I think in his case, it would be a very dangerous experiment that would fail, and then whether he could pick himself up and let reason rule, we'd have to see. I'm hopeful that that won't happen and that we'll have some sanity prevail in the Republican Party, which really needs to think through what kind of party is it.
For both of you then, and I know that both of you have a certain long view of history here. There have been many events in American history that have been variously entertaining or outrageously embarrassing to America over the last couple of generations, starting with, Watergate, the Checkers speech. Then you've got, Clinton and, stains on dresses and all kinds of just tawdry details that got him impeached. In the pantheon of American missteps and, faux pas, where would you put this?
I would put it up pretty high. We are bemoaning the fact that we have gridlock in Washington. I mean, the presidency he is not the all-powerful person that I think he thinks he will be if he gets in the White House. He'll find out pretty quickly that his powers are quite limited. Just ask Barack Obama. And right now, we're pretty frustrated by gridlock. If Trump gets elected, we may find gridlock is our best friend and the one thing that could save us and the rest of the world from some of his most reckless actions.
Ambassador Soderbergh, I'll give you the last word here. Where would you put this episode in the pantheon of embarrassing moments of America to the rest of the world? And any other comment you'd like to make?
Well, first of all, there's a big difference when it's a silly season of an election campaign and presidential mistakes once they get into office. I agree that America does have healthy checks and balances, and he's likely to go down as a failed president that didn't get a whole lot done. And that's, I think, something that will become very clear as his views, or lack thereof, become clear and people begin to run away from him once they really look at a Trump presidency. That's I'll try and end on a hopeful note for the country.
Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having us.
And Robert Mann is professor at the Louisiana State University and columnist at the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
Thank you, John.
Brazen murder in Pakistan from 2011 continues to send waves of repercussions through civic society already battered by religious violence. Mumtaz Qadri was a police officer who assassinated Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab and a Christian, in broad daylight in 2011. Qadri was hanged earlier this month after years of appealing his case in the Pakistani court system on the grounds that he was acting to eradicate blasphemy under Pakistani law. His eventual execution outraged his supporters, who descended on the capital on Sunday. They are promising to sit in front of the parliament until the government declares Qadri a martyr and promises not to change the blasphemy law, which seems to endorse violence against non-Muslims. But Pakistan has even bigger troubles. The suicide bomb in Lahore on Sunday was the most deadly terrorist attack the country has seen in over a year. And while it targeted Christians, the majority of those killed and injured were Muslim. Salman Hamid directs the Center for the Study of Science in Muslim Societies at Hampshire College. He joins us. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Hello.
So would you say that there is a tolerance for religious violence, even as Pakistani society tries to rein it in by the execution of Mr. Mumtaz Qadri?
Well, I think there are a lot of currents that are present right now in Pakistan, and there are people who are trying to stem this type of religious intolerance. But blasphemy law, which really took in effect in the 1980s under General ضیاء-الحق, that has allowed some sort of a little bit of license to general public to take matters in their own hands. And that has, in particular, taken a toll on non-Muslim minorities, as well as on Muslims who don't particularly fall into a particular religious doctrine.
But what is it about the last 10 years that seems to have sharpened this sense of conflicting signals over religious violence and religious intolerance? Pakistan does have problems with modernity on some level, but this seems to be accelerating.
I think there is a sharp divide that is taking place within the society, especially in the last few years. You are seeing a sharper division between the ever-shrinking liberal base in Pakistan and also the more conservative ones. And in the last 10 years, Pakistan has been under siege. You are seeing the Afghan war spilling over into Pakistan. And I think the increase in terror attacks that started to take place within Pakistan, I think it is an environment when you are under siege, when you are under threat. It is then when people use these kind of things to find an enemy within. And blasphemy law just provides you with a tool, because it is so easy to accuse somebody of blasphemy. All you have to do is to say, well, I heard somebody say something, or I saw somebody desecrate a page of the Quran. Now, there rarely is any serious investigation of whether those charges are true or not. Before that, you get a mob that gets riled up because of an insult or perceived insult to Islam, and it goes and takes matters in its own hands. So I think it is more than the last 10, 15 years with the Taliban and with the fight from Afghanistan jumping over into the Pakistani borders, that you start seeing an increase in the use of the blasphemy law, the accusations for people who have blasphemed. And I should mention, it's not just the minorities that have been the target. There have been many Muslims themselves. It gets very easy to settle scores.
Finally, there's a sense in the West that this is the voice of a backward elderly population that expresses this intolerance. But in fact, it's the younger generation that is embodying this conflicting set of messages on religious intolerance and is carrying this forward into the future. What does that hold for the next 10 to 20 years in Pakistan?
Well, I think this is a crucial time. Again, as I mentioned, that there is an increasing divide in the way people are approaching these questions and the questions of modernity, how to adjust to that level of tolerance, are right up front. But in this age of homeland, I should also mention that there are also people in Pakistan that are fighting against these type of injustices. And one case, for example, Salman Taseer himself is an example who was standing up to it, and he paid with his life. There are other lawyers who have been threatened. There are other lawyers who have given up their lives. But I think within the context of these kind of issues, we should also focus on the civil society, people who are fighting these kind of blasphemy laws, who are fighting these type of battles within Pakistan. That group also represents the young. That group also represents the future. But I think we will see which side is going to win out. But it's a crucial fight, because it is about the future generations.
Salman Hamid directs the Center for the Study of Science in Muslim Societies, a professor at Hampshire College. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Call me crazy, but did anyone actually believe that the FBI, if it really wanted to unlock that iPhone implicated in the San Bernardino terrorist attacks, that it couldn't do it on its own eventually? Come on. Do we really think that Tim Cook of Apple was holding back the dam of civil liberties against the entire FBI, NSA, Pentagon, and all those nerdy freelancers? Hackers in the Starbucks in Palo Alto, California. On Monday, the Justice Department found its own way to unlock that iPhone. Nuala O'Connor is the president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology and the former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security, 2003 to 2005. And we learned she was kind of rooting for Apple to win this one.
Well, it sadly validates Apple's position that encryption could be broken at this time with enough effort, enough employees, enough time. And yes, I think other companies or other actors, whether inside the government or outside, feel that they were trying to help, obviously, national security. It's certainly my position and many others' position that national security is actually served by having strong end-to-end encryption for this country and for our critical infrastructure, as well as our personal devices.
But I'm trying to think, why would you care if they were able to ultimately de-encrypt it, as long as they didn't compel a company to do it in civil liberties terms?
That's a very good point, John, and it's true. We very strongly objected to compulsion by any private sector actor on behalf of the government. But even more, breaking one iPhone means that all iPhones are broken. So I think we all feel a little less safe today in our personal communications and our devices. And breaking the encryption code means that's a permanent break in a much longer chain of security.
Is there anyone who will ask the important question of what was the value of any information obtained here and evaluate whether that was worth this entire confrontation?
Whether or not this one act really results in additional knowledge, the FBI has been arguing yes. Many others have argued the FBI has a lot of other ways, a lot of other tools at their disposal besides hacking permanently damaging encryption. I think that the harm to our personal security and our national security is actually greater than the solution in this case.
Although you can eloquently ask the question, and you certainly do there, it's abstract until the FBI says, see, look what we got out of this phone. It's very important information, but we're never going to know that, right?
Well, it's a phone, so there are two-party communications. We can always find the other person with the other end of that communication, even if this phone – what if this phone had been dropped in a river? What if this phone had been blown up? What if this phone had disappeared? There's lots of evidence that is lost in any investigation. There are lots of ways to find evidence in other sources and other methods in other individuals' hands. I take that this was an incredibly tragic event, and the FBI may or may not have chosen this investigation as the kind of lodestar for this argument about encryption and about personal devices. But it's not that I want to see the FBI ineffective. I want to see all of us safe, and I think that encrypted devices are a part of that future.
Do you have grounds to sue to get the FBI to disclose what it is they discovered once they unlock this phone?
I wouldn't say that we're thinking about that yet, although we were certainly active participants in the Apple FBI case in California, again, focused on the rights of the individual and the importance of end-to-end encryption.
Nuala O'Connor is currently the president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit focused on digital civil liberties. She's also the former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security from 2003 to 2005. Thanks so much, Nuala.
Thank you, John.
The Veterans Administration is facing a serious problem delivering mental health care to vets from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. One example, the widely cited suicide rate for recent vets is 50% higher than for civilians. Medical marijuana has been legalized across 23 states and in Washington, D.C., and veterans are seizing the opportunity to find alternatives to painkillers and other psychoactive drugs. The Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance in Northern California is now offering a different kind of treatment for PTSD or chronic pain, medical marijuana that's grown on-site and given free to participating soldiers. While federally illegal, the drug has shown to help manage pain and reduce muscle spasms in patients suffering from conditions like multiple sclerosis. Two clinical trials have shown it to help with psychosis for those with brain conditions like schizophrenia. Alyssa Jong Perry is a San Francisco-based journalist, and she visited a Veterans Alliance meeting on a recent weeknight. Alyssa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me today.
This suicide problem has been such a huge issue for the VA, for the military, for all of the vets who are dealing with all kinds of issues that are related specifically to PTSD, but also to how their injuries relate to PTSD. Let's get a sense from some of the people that you talk to of what the military has been doing. Here's a U.S. Air Force veteran, Jose Ortega.
I was given muscle relaxants, Flexeril, ibuprofen, you know, swelling reducers and all that, but it just didn't cooperate with my stomach. And the VA, you know, they don't prescribe cannabis, unfortunately. So, you know, it's just like an endless cycle of pills to take care of one symptom that the other caused. And so naturally I went over and to cannabis topically. And so that's kind of what helps for me.
And listen to this story. Here's Tim Hinman, who's a U.S. Navy veteran.
I took quite a bit of medicine, and then I actually was put on a lot of benzodiazepines and a lot of medicine that started making me very sick, black out, and have a lot of bad flashbacks and things like that. And so I had to go into the hospital and detox.
It sounds like a bit of an improvisational approach here. Try this pill and then try this pill to deal with this symptom and that sort of thing. I mean, it must have been horrible for these vets.
Yeah. And when I went to visit the Marijuana Compassion Project on a Monday evening, there were about 60 vets and all of them said the same thing. They were taking so many pills that they couldn't even understand who they were at that point. Mm. They couldn't even stay awake during the day, or they would be so hyped up on certain pills that then they have to take another pill to go to sleep. Jose Ortega, who we heard, he would take a pill so his joints wouldn't hurt, but then his stomach would hurt, or he would feel loopy during the day. So why not put a topical salve on your body and those joints to cure instead of inhaling a pill?
And here's Jake Scallon, who's actually working on the cannabis program. He's a U.S. Marine Corps veteran.
So right now I'm putting together our bags for our Veterans Compassion Program, and usually what they contain, they'll get 4 grams of raw cannabis flowers from grown by us, and then we also get other people that donate more flowers that we give to them. We had some wax cannabis concentrate donated to us, as well as some edibles.
And what's in these bags exactly?
Flowers are basically what you think of when you think of traditional marijuana, are right. The green buds.
Yeah.
So they get about 4 grams of that, and that's grown through the Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance. And the rest of it comes from donations, so edibles like a cookie,
I see.
A lollipop, gummy bears.
Gummy bears.
Yeah.
Well, that's an experience I've never had. So what's the impact in terms of treatment? How does it... Is it a calming kind of thing? Is it a pain reliever?
Yeah, I think it's for each patient. It's a different remedy. What happens is that they have to go to another doctor outside of the VA to sort of get this prescription and see what kind of works with them. So by the time I think most of these vets are getting this marijuana from the Alliance, they know what strain, what potency, and what will help with what. Everything is tested as well by state law, so they know exactly what they're getting is clean and pure. So some of it might be calming, so they might take a strain for anxiety. Someone might have extreme chronic pain, so then they can find a strain that's for them. Some people just can't smoke, so they eat a gummy bear.
So this is also something that's motivated very much out of the spirit of the veterans who are frustrated with the treatment that they are getting. I went to a college on the West Coast, and Santa Cruz had a particular reputation.
Right.
And so it's not an accident that the Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance is actually responsible for growing and producing the medication that becomes this treatment. Is that right?
Right. It's not ironic. The community has given them no backlash whatsoever. The police, I think that was a lot of questions everyone asked, are the police showing up when they're standing outside giving this weed? I'm like, nobody really cares. They just want to see people having safe access and healthy alternatives.
And the question really is, should the VA be studying this? Should the VA be looking at the medical value of this and getting some real statistics on it? Here's Aaron Newsom, who's the co-founder and head of development of the Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance.
We are using this as a medicine. The VA needs to recognize that. And we at least need to move forward in this, because we are replacing our pharmaceuticals with medical cannabis, and it's a safer alternative.
Any Pentagon reaction to this? Any official top of the military, top of the VA, as far as what they say about all of this?
Yeah. So I talked to the national headquarters of the VA, and they stay with the stance that marijuana is a Schedule I drug. And so when you think of Schedule I drugs, you're thinking of the lines of cocaine and heroin. Therefore, the VA cannot prescribe or recommend marijuana. But if you do live in the 23 states where medical marijuana is legal, you're able to tell your doctor that you're taking it, but that's it.
So the VA, it's fair to say that the VA is sympathetic, but they're hamstrung by current law. And until somebody changes that, they're just going to have to wait and see.
Sort of. But recently, over 20 different lawmakers have signed a letter and sent it directly to the headquarters of the VA, asking the VA to recommend and prescribe marijuana to these veterans. But it's been almost 2 months now, and there's been absolutely no response from the VA.
Well, that wouldn't suggest that they consider this an urgent issue, at least at this point. Alyssa Jong Perry is a San Francisco-based journalist who pitched this story to us. She's been reporting on cannabis programs for veterans on the West Coast. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Six years ago, A young African-American man gave a speech at his Atlanta high school in a voice choked with pride.
I will not stand before you today, honored and humbled to be the first African-American male valedictorian of Booker T. Washington High School in more than a decade.
As proud as valedictorian Deontay Bridges was 6 years ago, the idea of an African-American at the top of his class was not unusual at Booker T. Washington High School. There must have been just as much pride, but an extra measure of bravery as well, when a young African-American, Alvin Hall, stood before a largely white audience under a Confederate flag at Wakulla County, Florida High, delivering the valedictory speech for the class of 1970. That silence is all that's left of that prideful moment. Alvin Hall has gone on to do well, as valedictorians often do, author of nearly a dozen books about financial literacy. He's an art collector, a TV and radio host. But that one little credential that started him on his way has been erased from history until a few weeks ago. He returned to his hometown with the takeaway tagging along.
Since 1976 or 1977, I've not driven past the school or seen the school.
Wow, it's now the Wakulla County Eagles. It was the Wakulla County Rebels. And the school mascot was the Rebels, and the school flag was the Confederate flag.
All this week, you will hear Alvin's story of his return to Wakulla, where he grew up in poverty with six siblings. Part of a Black History Month celebration, because Alvin was his school's first Black valedictorian. But Alvin's name and picture was not part of that history. Instead, he says, two white girls who had graduated that same year as salutatorians replaced the picture of his young face, ready to take on the world. And now Alvin Hall's emotional return to Wakulla High School, where he took a small but important step in the struggle for racial justice in America.
Wow, it is the same. This place was really Southern growing up, and they held on to those Southern values and that sort of life before the Confederacy. It was all over this place. It was all over this place. Yeah, we used to gather out here, and this is exactly the same. Yep, lunchroom was here. My locker was down this hallway. Down here was where the graduation was.
My old high school. I graduated in 1970. The people have changed, but the place looks essentially the same. Until you see how it has grown in what used to be a field behind the school. After visiting the school in the mid-70s, I vowed never to return. I knew my past as the school's first African-American valedictorian was being deliberately forgotten by those who ran the school back then. The message to me was simple and clear. As a Black American, you don't own your own history. 40 years on, it was time to correct the truth that had been ignored.
Let me introduce you to Ms. Hutchinson. She's also on
hello,
our committee.
Hello, Ms. Hutchinson. Alvin Hall.
Thank you so much thank for you. Being here. We're thank so you. Excited.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. It's really emotional. Much more so than I thought it would be, actually. Oh, here we are. Wow. There's Deborah Coxwell, who is a salutatorian, and Melinda Harvey. We all look so young. Why don't you sit over here? In this section, close in, please. Good morning. My name is Alvin Hall, and I was valedictorian of the class of 1970. And the first thing I did when I graduated was to run away from this place. I knew from a very early age that I wanted to leave Wakulla County, and my whole being was designed to get out of Wakulla County. So this is my first visit back here. I've literally not seen the school. Not been back here since 1976. And in essence, and I think I can talk about this, I was kind of erased from history here because we were the third integrated class. And as a Black valedictorian here, it was very, very controversial in the 1970s. And so when I came back here and I saw that my picture was no longer up, I decided that my time with the school was done. I took my class ring and sold it, and I never looked back, and I never came by the school again. So when people sort of discovered me and asked me back, I decided it's time to come back and see this. So I'm here today to answer any questions you want about anything. Yes.
So are you rich now?
having learned about Wall Street and how money works. That helped me start to develop my own financial security because I was raised extremely poor. We used to say I was raised poor. I was so poor we couldn't even afford the O-R in the word. That's how poor we were. It was really poor. When I left here, my grandmother gave me $50 in a little floral handkerchief, and it had $50 in that little handkerchief. And she put that in my hand. I remember she took it out of her bra and put it in my hand. I still remember that too, right? And she gave me that money. And she said, you know, if you're ever in trouble. You know, I kept that $50 until 1991. I never spent that money. Did I think my life would be what it is today? Never, 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 never. Do I take any of this for granted? No, because it could all change tomorrow.
What one piece of advice could you give me for the future?
Remain open to the possibility that good things will happen.
Do you think growing up in McCullough County like affected your life at all?
Oh, yeah. I was lucky to be raised in a community of people who really care about me. And so I've created families everywhere I go in the world. So although I don't come back home, where's my nephew? My nephew is here. He's right there. Right. And he can tell you I didn't come home very often. I create families everywhere I go. It's quite a journey from Wakulla High to Yale. But it all began here. And while I might have been a curiosity to some of the old administrators, there were some special individual people who saw something in me that I was unaware of. One of those who championed me further was Miss Freddie Grooms.
God, it's good.
It's so good to see you.
And a big success you are.
Thank you, thank you.
I am so proud of you.
I have been talking about you all my life because without you having talked and got me to Yale Summer High School, I don't know where I would have been today. That single act changed my entire life.
You know, the most satisfying thing in the world is to have your students say you made a difference.
And you did.
That's really what I consider the best compliment that you could have.
Yep.
After all these years, somebody still thinks that I made a difference.
I feel very lucky that I, at this point in my career, had the opportunity to say to you what you meant to me. Because you didn't know me from anybody else, but you would. I thought when you were talking to the group, you were often talking to me. To me.
Phew.
That's true. That's what I thought.
I think I might have been. Oh, gosh.
And it changed everything.
This is too much.
It changed everything for me.
Sometimes I don't think the young people realize their own greatness. It just takes time for them to sense it. I'm sorry. This is going to be too much. But it's just wonderful when it works.
Yep,
when
it works.
It is.
Changed my life.
Mine
too. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Tomorrow, Alvin's journey continues as we learn about his family, his faith, and who gave him his first piece of financial advice. Did your high school experience have a lasting impact? If you could go back, what would you tell your younger self? Miami, Florida. High school was a melee of frustrations, laughter, crushes, heartbreak, countless study hours and homework and tests, but it was a necessary experience. If I could go back and mentor my younger self, I would tell myself, you are you and nobody else. Don't conform. Don't settle. You don't need to please others. But God, be beautifully you. We'll have more on Alvin Hall's return to his hometown of Wakulla, Florida this week. We'll be posting all of his stories at thetakeaway.org/Alvin Hall. And as always, tell us your story. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.